What do you do if you're faced with a crisis? You consult your friends, you talk to people you trust who may or may not be able to help you. And those friends, if they're good ones and capable, may even be able to alert you to crises that you hadn't even considered and give you advice on how to handle them. Now, in politics, as we all know, you rarely have friends, but you do have allies who share at least some of your interests. And the German government has just decided it's about time that it sit down together regularly and be advised on security and crisis matters. What? You're saying they didn't have that so far? Well, not in a condensed format. They didn't. Today on Berlin Briefing, we'll be talking about Germany's new National Security Council that will convene in future, whose task it will be to develop scenarios for emergencies. So will it really be a game changer? To discuss all that, I'm joined here in the studio by two superbly informed people. Sarah Bresson is a research fellow at the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's really cool that you're here. And Markus Pinder is security correspondent for Germany's public radio station, DLF. And Markus, I'd like to start with you. Can you explain what is that new National Security Council?
It is an institution, a small, very small institution. It consists of the chancellor, the second chancellor, the vice chancellor, and a couple of ministers who are basically concerned with questions of international policy. They have a staff of only 13 people. That is really small in comparison to, for example, the American National Security Council. But they are there to gather information. They are pooling information and they're providing situational awareness for the whole German government. And that is important. It is in the chancellery. It gives the chancellor a little more power opposite to the foreign ministry, which I think is important. But in times that ask for immediate reactions and immediate solutions sometimes, it makes the German government in terms of foreign policy more agile and a little more consistent. At least that's the hope.
But, you know, the way you've described it just now, it feels as though that is something that the German government should have had for a long time. So, Sarah, can you tell us what happened? Why didn't Germany have that so far? And how did they discuss these security matters beforehand?
So I think it's worth noting that, at least as far as I can remember, we haven't had a chancellor who made foreign policy, global politics, international security a priority voluntarily, right? They did so, Merkel had to do so, Scholz had to do so because of crises. Crises that came and that built up until they couldn't ignore them anymore. And that's really something that we see changing now, where we have a chancellor who was called kind of the foreign chancellor in his first weeks, who tackles foreign policy or says he would tackle foreign and security policy more proactively. And so setting up this council absolutely makes sense to be able to do that. Why Germany hasn't had that? I mean, I mentioned that more recently, chancellors have not made that their priority. In the last government coalition talks before the so-called traffic light coalition came into power, the parties that went into power were not in favor. We usually had a foreign minister from a different party than the chancellor was.
Yeah, that is different now. They're both from the Conservatives.
Exactly. So that is different now. That makes it a little bit easier because you do not have a foreign minister who risks or is afraid of losing power in comparison to a very strong chancellor who might become even stronger when this person defines the national security agenda in the chancellery with the National Security Council.
But of course, you know, we have a system that is different to, say, the United States or to France. If you could just describe to us, how is that new National Security Council going to be different from the way say, the American president or the French president deals with matters?
Yeah, it's exactly right. It starts with the fact that we do not have a presidential system, right? So constitutionally, the chancellor, I mean, the president in Germany has representative largely functions. And the chancellor...
Yeah, we do have a president, but hardly anybody knows him, right?
Exactly.
Frank Walter Steinmeier.
Exactly. So it's what you have in the UK being the prime minister, or in other systems as well, the chancellor. In this role of basically coordinating the government, but there is a lot of autonomy in the different ministers. So the different ministries have essentially autonomy largely over their area of policy, be it defense, be it development, interior security, and all of these things. And so that means that as a chancellor, you coordinate things. Very rarely the chancellor kind of says, okay, now I need to use more power, basically, as being the chancellor, and use kind of a bit more compelling words to come to a decision. But the essential decision-making body is the cabinet as a whole, and that will stay the same with the new National Security Council. The only difference being that a select group of ministers, as we heard, will have the chance to more in-depth, ideally a bit more forward-looking, early on, with better preparation, with a common basis of information, which hasn't been there in the past, discuss international security topics. But in the end, the decisions will be made the same way that they have been, and it will still be the cabinet. So we're not changing our system of government, but we're also professionalizing, in a sense, the national security part.
And we had Donald Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton, on the program last week in our last episode. But there's not going to be such a role in that new National Security Council, right, Markus?
There's not such a role. As I said, the chancellor presides over the National Security Council. And it largely depends on the chancellor's decision on how to act and how to react to certain international developments. So it is an institution that is pooling information, that gives recommendations, policy recommendations, but it is there is no institutional solution to political questions. Usually, you have to have the act to will. Chancellor Merz now is very much involved in foreign policy, as Sarah just said. So it still depends. It's not a powerful bureaucracy like the National Security Council. It is more of an instrument.
You mean the American National Security Council? What were you referring to?
Yes, it is more. It's less powerful than the American National Security bureaucracy, of course.
And before we get to some points of criticism, etc., because not everybody is completely in agreement with this body, we do have to just listen to what Friedrich Merz said when he announced that new setup. And he did sound very proud. Let's just listen to the German Chancellor.
Russia is and will remain the greatest threat to freedom, peace and stability in Europe for a long time to come. And the German government is responding to this with determination. Russia has long been carrying out hybrid attacks against us through sabotage, cyber attacks and targeted disinformation. We see this when cables in the Baltic Sea are destroyed. We see it in targeted attacks on our IT security. We see it in massive interference in our democracy. The cabinet has therefore launched important projects today. An important decision taken today is the establishment of a National Security Council. This issue has been under discussion in Germany for 30 years. This coalition has decided on it in 4 months, and today has also begun its parliamentary process.
Yeah, parliamentary debate will start, of course. All of these matters that concern security, all the other packages that were also announced this week, like the military conscription that we've talked about on this podcast as well, a lot. All of that is going to reach the German parliament for more debate. Can you tell us, Marcus, there was a Federal Security Council, or there is, but that one was tasked with different issues. What did the Federal Security Council do that is now going to be integrated in that process of the National Security Council?
I think the most important task they had up to now was to decide whether or not to do arms exports to foreign countries. That was a large part of their decision making. They could also be called together in crisis situations, but that was rarely the case. So,
and it was always complicated because there was no automatic system in place, right?
Exactly. Plus, there was no system of experts who provided them with information. So more or less, every ministry was looking to get a broader picture of the of international relations for themselves, rather than relying on a common basis of facts and listening to the recommendations of foreign policy experts.
Mm-hmm. And there was also a security cabinet, just so that we get into the details of what, how were these issues discussed so far and what is going to change? Why did Friedrich Merz sound so proud when he made that announcement saying, I've ended, essentially, or we've ended decades of debate?
Yeah. So to go back also to your question of why Germany hasn't had such a council before, I mean, we have to think back really the fact that after Second World War, Germany was occupied by the Allied forces, right? And developed its new constitution or basic law and the entire democratic system that we have right now in West Germany, basically also under the oversight of these allies that had just experienced Germany starting a world war, right? So it's not actually that much of a coincidence that we don't have a strong president anymore. There is historical baggage around that, and there are reasons for why, for example, also in NATO, there was back then a secretary general who said even NATO was created to keep the Germans down, right? To not have Germany be strong. Germany didn't have an army in the first years. So all of these things, that's the historical background. Now, fast forward to today, we're in a completely different global situation, right? We've had repeatedly allies, partners, other Europeans, even calling for German leadership internationally in security matters, in European security, which is a big departure from what we had back then, right? And we had gradual shifts in this area. And to take that leadership, we need the structures, basically. So that, I think, is a rationale on the part of the government to now say, let's do this.
Okay, so we've established now that it was made easier, of course, with the very strong role of the Conservatives in this government, because now the foreign ministry is also from the Conservatives. So that means the Chancellor can work together very closely with the foreign minister, whereas in the past, of course, the foreign ministers were also very confident people who didn't want to hand too much of security assessments even over to the Chancellor. And I think we do have to also look at how Annalena Baerbock, the Green foreign minister in the last government, she came up with a national security strategy. Why was that not enough?
Well, strategies are strategies, and they're written on papers, and sometimes shorter, sometimes longer papers. But whether or not you adjust your policies according to a certain strategy that your basically political opponent has written is something totally different.
Second, because, of course, her chancellor was Olaf Scholz from the Social Democrats, a different
exactly,
party, right?
Exactly. Olaf Scholz did not realize, basically, how important it was that Germany positioned itself within the occurring crisis right now, vis-a-vis the threat from Russia. He was very reluctant to do anything. He was very reluctant to finally give allowed the Ukraine to have, listen to this, 36 tanks. That's not very much. So he was very reluctant to confront Russia. The Greens and the FDP, the Liberal Party, were much more in tune with certain of our European allies confronting Russia. Olaf Scholz never realized the importance of Germany. A Polish foreign minister said, you just alluded to that, that he feared German inaction more than action. So that coming from a Polish minister with the history that we have tells us something.
With Poland being the first country that Germany invaded
exactly.
when it launched the Second World War.
Exactly. And that tells us something about a changed political environment and a completely changed political situation that Olaf Scholz didn't quite realize. And many in his party do not realize this until today, which is a problem for Friedrich Merz, the chancellor. But that's a different story. Thing is, you have to have the political will to act and to decisively act and to realize that Germany, with its industrial strength, with its manpower, cannot hide and duck from the relevant and enormously important and dangerous questions that have arisen with the Russian war against Ukraine. So an institution like the new National Security Council in Germany cannot make up for missing political will or missing the political realization of what the situation is like.
Can you, yeah, if I just can come in on this, because I think the last government and you mentioned Olaf Scholz and their decisions after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, gradually deciding how much to support Ukraine, what to not deliver to Ukraine in terms of weapon systems and support, then deliver, huge public debates, dissatisfactions, also the population not really being able to follow. So why weren't we doing this 2 months ago and now we're doing it and all of the public fights around this? I think that was a phase that really showed how much it can backfire if you don't have the procedures that are now being established in the National Security Council. People rightly often ask, would any decision have been different if we had such a council before, right? Of course, I mean, you cannot tell. It's a counterfactual in history. But I think it's quite hard to imagine. I mean, the security cabinet that you mentioned, basically the ministers working on the security portfolio, meeting in an improvised format throughout the last government's period and the war on Ukraine was one kind of attempt at in an improvised way making up for the challenge that everyone had different information. You know, the chancellor thought about doing something, needed to get the information from the defense ministry. How much tanks do we actually have? Are they running? For what do we need them? All of this, you know, I mean, I think it's quite plausible that just the fact that there wasn't an agreed on information basis, a good situational picture, and these high level rounds that the discuss these things in a way also with the support of the staff and the chancellery in a structured way was a disadvantage and that it would be different in the next situation like this.
Yeah, and of course it put the German chancellor into the spotlight as well. Everybody was looking at what Olaf Scholz was going to do or not going to do. Everybody sort of tried to understand his motives, even people who were not critics of him said, OK, I really just want to understand the reasoning behind it. But I know you just said that it's very difficult to say which decisions would have been made differently, aside from Ukraine and how to essentially react to Russia's threat against Europe. What else comes to mind, Sarah?
Summer is here and vacation is calling. So at the end of July, we're bringing you a special series with our favorite tips for living a greener life. From what to look out for in your sunscreen to how to reduce your dog's environmental paw print, we'll get insights and advice from the experts and have a look at our own habits. Find our Greener Living series from Living Planet wherever you get podcasts.
I mean, what came to my mind is, for example, energy dependence on Russia. That was something to be discussed way in advance. It's not clear, had it been discussed with a more holistic analysis, everyone sitting together, maybe also getting, as you mentioned, allied governments, different governments who have similar experiences into the room, providing their information, providing their view on the matter, getting experts. There's analysis of how much, basically, experts on Russia and Eastern Europe have consistently pointed out how problematic Germany's dependency on Russia was, even pre the full-scale invasion. So recognizing that early on, and we remember how big of a strain it was on the government, but also on ordinary Germans, the energy prices, how hard it was to kind of, you know, manage that crisis, reduce dependency, where to get alternative energy sources from. So that is definitely one example. Others come to mind, like, for example, technical providers in the 5G network, which was also a topic.
Chinese debate.
Exactly. So would you want Chinese companies in critical infrastructure as providers or not? Again, we cannot say whether, for example, Angela Merkel and her government would have made a fundamentally different decision. But the whole dynamic of whether something like this goes onto the agenda. At the same time, I think thinking about these options also shows what the potential weakness of the new council could be, because as is planned right now, it would still be the chancellery and basically the office for the National Security Council that prepares the agenda, right? And so getting things onto the agenda that maybe a chancellor does not want to hear about, does not want to confront, there's no new option to basically have, I don't know, the opposition or anyone else kind of put this onto the agenda, right? So again,
it's not going to be public meetings, right? I mean, this is not something where the public can say, okay, we demand to hear, to listen in, to be able to sit and watch you debate all these top secret questions.
Right? Yeah, no, exactly. And even the decisions can be public, but they won't have to be. And so it's at the discretion of the chancellery and the ministers to decide what will be classified and what won't be. And so it's not clear that we will have the things on the agenda that we'd want to have on the agenda, and that also the transparency will be there around those decisions to a greater degree than they were in the past.
And Marcus, climate, for example, was something that was very much highlighted by the previous government. Olaf Scholz from the SPD was in a government with the Green Party, who basically got into that position because of their very strong climate agenda. Now that's off the table, right?
Well, climate is not an immediate concern. It has repercussions on military strategy, on strategy overall. But I don't think it has a place in the National Security Council. The National Security Council can always ask for advice as to how does this actually affect our policies or should affect our policies, but I think it's not an immediate security policy concern. The problem is that some of our actors or political actors, for example, the Social Democratic Party, live in a strategic reality 50 years ago, mm-hmm. back in the past, where the Soviet Union was a conservative power holding on to its territories, but not being confrontative, not being aggressive.
Not trying to expand.
Exactly. And right now we're confronted with a revisionist Russia. And a lot of social democrats still think they could somehow cooperate with Putin at a certain point of time when certain conditions are met. And I think that is a big problem. So if you live in a completely different strategic reality, you cannot come up with solutions of actual political problems.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, one idea of the National Security Council is also that, for example, the team that works for the council prepares scenario analyses, right? So there's a unit that is supposed to bring together analyses from the government, from different ministries, or also do their own analyses that look more further into the future. Again, not just like what situation do we have right now and what happened yesterday and what are our constraints, but really where do we, where might Europe stand in 10 years, in 5 years' time? And that's really something that has been lacking in German foreign and security policy making, right? Again, I'm mentioning kind of waiting until the crisis is there and then being kind of late to respond.
Afghanistan is another
example. Exactly. It's another example. But it's not just about late reaction and then unideal kind of position to be in, but it's also, I mean, currently Germany is investing a lot more in defense than it used to be. And you also need to convince the population why this is needed, right? And one way to do this is to invoke the threat, to constantly saying Russia might attack NATO, look at what's happening in Ukraine, we need to defend ourselves. An additional way is also to say, what is our plan? Like, proactively, where do we want to go, right? Not just kind of closing down and like, you know, being the ostrich head in the sand or something like that. But in order to also back to the point of strategy, to have a strategy, to develop a strategy, to also hope that, for example, young people join the armed forces to know what they are fighting for. I mean, everybody works on these topics of like future security strategy topics as you also need a positive vision for people. You need to have a vision of, for example, Germany as a democracy with many other democracies around us in decline, authoritarian backsliding powers in office, Trump, Orban, all of this, and also additional new kind of self-confidence of authoritarians globally. Does it mean it's only going to get worse and at best I can defend my hometown? Or is there any vision of like what we want actually in a positive sense? And so for that, I mean, it's a big topic to do the analyses, to be better prepared, but also to use that as a basis for formulating a new security strategy, for example, and an entire narrative that makes Germany's role in global politics and international security compelling and make it make sense to people.
I think you made a very important point here. Let's remember the last chancellor said, Ukraine must not lose this war, Russia must not win this war, which is actually a non-starter to communicate with the public. It was the vague...
Because he didn't say Russia has to lose or Ukraine has to win because he didn't want to define what winning means.
At least he should have said Ukraine has to survive and under good circumstances and therefore we should help Ukraine. He never said that so in that kind of explicit form. He never tried to convince the public. He tried not to frighten people, which is not enough as a foreign policy strategy.
Well, at the same time, he would always argue, I can't send any of those long-range weapons to Ukraine because they might then attack Moscow. And we all don't want to get into a situation where Moscow feels compelled to react to German weapons attacking their capital.
Yeah, so, which was kind of a weak excuse because
it was not a coherent communicative strategy.
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians have never demonstrated that they were willing to use.
I'm not defending Olaf Scholz, by the way. I'm just saying that because you just said he tried to not instill fear in people.
Yeah.
At the same time, sometimes he did. So it was not coherent.
It reminds me a bit of one minister who once, you know, had this press conference and said, I cannot tell you more details because it would make people more insecure.
Yeah.
Like, you know, remember this? And it's like, if you sit there as a minister and say, I have information, but it would really scare you, then that makes people kind of scared, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that was missing. And he was the former chancellor. We have to talk about this because he was actually overlooking basic facts and not confronting realities. As I said, the Ukrainians never used attack weapons on civilians. They only used it on military installations.
Right.
Yes. So it was kind of a dishonest game he played. And if a politician is determined to do that, he will do that, whether or not there's a National Security Council that says otherwise. That's what I meant. There is no institutional solution to political inaction.
But again, I think judging basically how Olaf Scholz acted also illustrates again the catch-22 you're in if you do not have the means, right? Again, we talk about ceasefire or even hopefully at some point maybe peace in Ukraine, and who could secure that? Who could secure that, right? Which troops could secure that? And immediately the question is, the foreign minister recently said, oh, I don't know if actually the defense minister has the troops to do it, right? So again, I mean, it also back then, Germany just wasn't in a very strong position. I think considerations for Olaf Scholz were real in terms of, okay, how much do we give and to what extent is it my responsibility to defend Germany, and will I still be able to do that? We're heavily relying on allies, we're heavily relying on the US. Yes, okay, Biden was in power, so we could sort of still rely on that. But that's the tricky situation, and that's also why these things need to go together. You need better information that they didn't have. You need more ground to stand on, right, in terms of material, equipment, troops, and all of that, to be assertive internationally. Also, that they didn't have, right? So that's kind of all pieces of the puzzle that need to come together to be able to act differently.
I just want to, because we're running out of time, but I just want to ask you very specifically: do you expect the new National Security Council to come up with a new assessment of the current security threats that Germany is faced with this year still, or when can we see tangible results?
I mean, I think the threat assessment part is really important. There are already means in place to do this, but I would hope it becomes more forward-looking, as I mentioned. And I really hope, and I'm not sure at the moment if that's what it's going to be, that there will be a comprehensive threat assessment that's forward-looking and a strategy that follows from that. Because it's one thing to do a threat assessment and then to write the political strategy that you want to write, or to basically, which I think is the sensible way of doing it, really have the strategy follow from a comprehensive threat assessment. And so that's really something I hope. And if I may, just the last point, because climate came up, I think it's an interesting topic. Yes, it's not now mentioned as being on the agenda of the National Security Council. But for example, the defense sector does a lot on climate, right? Even under Trump 1, when President Donald Trump in the US said climate is a hoax and climate change doesn't exist, the military basically raised port levels to be to make sure that their ships can still run if kind of ocean levels, you know, rise.
Yeah, sea level rise.
All of these things, right? And then in NATO, the same thing, where also the forward-looking analyses come in. And if someone tells you your helicopter won't fly anymore if we have 5 degrees more in this environment. So the military is very, very aware of this, right? And so it's something where I don't think people need to be afraid that this completely falls off. It's a necessity, and most people know that, in especially the defense domain.
You just mentioned the National Security Strategic Paper that was written in the last coalition government in Germany. The National Security Council will be tasked with developing on that, based on that strategy, further policy recommendations. And I think that's a very good idea to have, as you said, Sarah, a forward-looking body who is actually providing politicians with an outlook in the not only in the short term but also in the medium and long term.
Okay, and I'd like to end with you two with sort of a guesstimate. What do you think will the role of the US be in the first paper that the new National Security Council will come up with? How will Germany assess the United States in that?
An ally who goes missing.
Sarah?
Who goes missing? I'm not sure if they're that confident to say that publicly. So I'm a bit more cautious whether they will really say we're losing an ally, but I think it will be a formulation around like the rise of non-democratic and alliances and things we cannot rely on anymore in a lot of the insecurity language. Whether they will point out the US specifically, I'm not so sure about.
Any last points you want to make that we haven't addressed so far?
I think assessing the US in the coming years is actually a very important point, because we have to plan as if the United States are not there anymore. That's what we have to do. That's what European sovereignty, a term the French president often uses, will be about. And I think that's going to be our main problem. On the other hand, it puts a lot of pressure on the Europeans to get their stuff together. We have relied on the United States much too far. Even Barack Obama, already in 2014, said the Germans are, what term did he use, free riders. Mm. So we should have seen this coming a long time ago, and now we have to.
I would also just say, that even the National Security Council relies on ministers cooperating, and it's not a given that they will. So it's not a given game changer. This can still go wrong. And then also to what you said, the European security order at the moment is, we don't really know what it's going to be, right? How that ties into a global security order, that we're completely dealing with a different game in all of those areas where Germany has, for example, funded security funded aid project, where there were military missions in the past, the Sahel, the Middle East, all of these areas where the US isn't present anymore. The game is a new one on so many different levels. And it's really overdue that Germany, and then in the European context, really fundamentally reconsiders what we're doing there, because it'd be weird to just continue the way we continue. But in the past, what has happened mostly was to look to the US, to look to the UK, how do they deal with new things. But that's not really where we can look and where we should look anymore, right? So where do we look? Or do we need to be the ones who define this for ourselves and internally with the European partners that who are on the same page?
And those are a lot of questions that you would like to, that we would like to hear your opinion on. So do send us those comments, and we're looking forward to the discussion. Please be kind to each other. Just a quick reminder, especially on social media. That's very important. Cannot be said often enough. But so far, thanks very much, Sarah. Thanks very much, Marcus, for this lively discussion. And thank you, of course, out there watching on YouTube, wherever you found us on the regular podcast providers. Make sure that you come back.